Hello, my name is Clemens. I'm a history student at the Freie Universität Berlin, and I have the great honor today to take Alex's role in this bonus episode about the Battle of von Linden. We got in touch a few weeks ago, and he asked me to be part of the podcast, and I jumped straight in, and I'm not alone here today. I got wonderful guests, some more known to the regular listeners than others, but I'm joined by David Hollands and Hans Karl. Maybe introduce yourselves as well. I mean, David, we actually already know you, so maybe you just reintroduce yourself for a bit.
Yes, okay. Yes, hello, I'm David Hollands. I've been doing some recordings on the Second Coalition War with Alex. You'll have heard me talking about Italy and Germany. My main interest is the Austrian army, mostly under the command of Archduke Charles and his staff officers. And so I'll be taking the Austrian side today.
Okay, and very wonderful to have you here. And to keep it balanced, we of course need the French side. So maybe Hans Karl, you go ahead.
I don't know if I'm a big balance. My name is Hans Karl Weiss. I'm living in Bavaria, in Bamberg, which was always Reichstreu and Catholic, so always on the losing side of the Austrians. But I'm quite interested in the history of the French Revolutionary Wars and also Napoleonic time, and especially all things where Bonaparte did not take part.
I join you in that opinion. Not the greatest fan either. Okay, but luckily he won't be part of this today. I mean, we will mention his name at some point, but we got some other great names in the middle here. And I think we just jump straight in. There are a lot of talking points for today. And maybe I thought we start talking about the situation immediately before the battle. There was much going on in the month before December 1800. And I thought we start by explaining the Austrian situations, what they were planning to do upcoming to the Battle of von Linden. And maybe, David, you'll take the Austrian side. You'll take us straight in.
Right. Yes. Well, we left it off there at the end of Q2 with the Battle of Hochstadt and then the armistice at Parsdorf there in the middle of July. And that basically left the opposing forces either side of the River Inn, which is kind of halfway between Munich and the Austrian border. And at this time, the Austrians decided they would change the command over, and Cry was relieved of command and replaced by Archduke John, as Archduke Charles had refused to take command. And John's got about 64,000 in his Austro-Bavarian army, and also about another 15,000 Holy Roman Empire troops. And of course, being an 18-year-old Archduke, he's not very military experienced, Franz von Lauer, who had been the chief of staff for Wurmser in Italy in 1796, was appointed as his adlatus or advisor. And the chief of staff is Weyrother, the aggressive Oberst or Colonel Franz von Weyrother, who we last encountered as the chief of staff at Rivoli. And the thing about Weyrother really is that the Austrian chief of staff is a very powerful figure because the politicians, he was kind of a puppet of the politicians. He was known as one of Tugut's Benjamins or little helpers. And the Tugut would advise the emperor on the appointment of the president of the Hofkriegsrat, and the Hofkriegsrat would then make the senior army appointments in wartime. And so he's pretty much there, controlled by Tugut's policy. He'd been at the engineering school originally, and he took a very scientific approach to planning. So he's very much like Mack. He's got these elaborate columns and timetables and all this kind of thing. But his problem seems to be that he's not really considering the terrain. So the armistice is renewed in September. But then it lapsed on the 12th of November, and encouraged by British subsidies, the Austrians decided that there in the middle of November, they would start on an offensive campaign into Bavaria. And the initial plan was to sweep round to the north of Munich and then cut the French communications off to the west, and thereby force Moreau back out of Bavaria, leaving the Holy Roman Empire and emigre troops guarding the line of the Inn. But of course, it was the middle of November, it's bad weather, and the roads were bad, and so the artillery and the supplies simply couldn't keep up, and the whole plan was abandoned. So Lauer then persuades Archduke John and Weyrother that it would be better to go just for a direct march on Munich, just to drive the French out. So the first thing that happens is the Austrians cross the Inn on the first on at the end of November. Now the Inn runs kind of parallel to the main road between Munich and Vienna. So they crossed and then they headed for a small town called Ampfing, where the French had their main positions of Grenier's corps. And Ampfing is a fairly straightforward battle. The two main divisions went in from the left and the right. So you have Latour on the attacking the French left and Riche attacking the French right, whilst a small sort of advance guard under Lippert would distract the French front line, with the reserve corps under Collarat sitting behind them. Fairly standard sort of 7 Years' War revolutionary period attack. The French, as I said, have only got Grenier there, and they would then initially would go round to down to the south, down to the southwest of Ampfing. He would march in there. He attacked Ney's positions around Aschau am Inn, but he got kind of bogged down there against Ney. He pushed him out of Aschau, but then was pushed back in. Lippert wasn't making too much advance there. He only had a few troops anyway. But the main advance was made by Latour, and he was able to get in between the French centre under Hardy and its left under Grandjean and Legrand. And so he was able to help Lippert, and eventually they drove, after about, they'd been fighting for about 10 hours, they drove the French out of Ampfing.
Thank you first for this great introduction. A lot of stuff going on there. I have questions, but Hans Karl, maybe you'll take the next point.
Just a bit from the French side. Of course, there was a liaison with Bonaparte and Moreau when the armistice was breaking up. And the French had a broad scheme, actually attacking from on a broad front, starting in Italy. You know, they were under Mincio, and Bellegarde was opposing them, and they should break through and conquer the Adige Valley. And then in the middle, MacDonald should be the liaison officer to Moreau. And on the Main Valley, we have Augereau. So Moreau is a mosaic in a big French attacking plan, hopefully breaking through to Vienna. But when you look at the disposition of Moreau's corps, Moreau's army, the Armée du Rhin, then you see it's really far, far, far stretched. And it has more or less, in my view, a very defensive position. And the sort of, there is no big strategy on the side of Moreau. He says just, okay, I have to do a reconnaissance in force. And he's pushing to the Inn. And then we come to the encounter at Ampfing, or Haun, it's the other name of the battle. And there, it's just by accident, it was not planned. And the momentum is with the Austrians, because they took the initiative to cross the Inn. So Moreau has to react on this. And when he sees that he has only one corps, Grenier's, then he is withdrawing. So that's, I think, is the basic broad picture from the French side.
I mean, the thing that is quite interesting to me, that we have all these supposed to be moving parts and intricate plans as Hans Karl said, the French want to attack from so many regions all across southern Europe, actually. And the Austrians with this elaborate plan to make this much ground in Bavaria. Interesting to me that all these plans were made so far out of campaigning season. As you said, in November they had these plans, in December these battles went on. So were these realistic timetables, or was it like doomed to fail, in your opinion, maybe?
Leuthen was fought in December. Austerlitz was fought in December. Hohenlinden is fought in December. So December in Europe is still a campaigning month when you look in the history of campaigns. The area maybe was a bit difficult because it was very close to the Alps.
Yeah, it's worse terrain, though. The roads, I think, in some of the other places are better. But I think there was also political pressure, particularly from the British on the Austrians with the new subsidy. And also, of course, this is the first time that the French have actually held on in Bavaria. Moreau got there in 1796, and Jourdan did get some way into Bavaria in 1799. But in each time, they were driven out. And this time, they've secured their positions. And so there is a lot of pressure from the point of view of being of France being the Holy Roman Emperor and responsible for Germany as well. So I think those pressures are probably what's driving Austrian policy.
So we cleared what's happened before the battle. I think maybe now it's time to actually look to the evening before the battle, especially on the French side, because as I understand, there were some really important parts moving for the rest or for the consequences of the battle. And so I think we'll go with Hans Karl there.
The consequence was actually that made a decision of Hohenlinden, because the French withdrew. Johann thought, okay, they are retreating. They're retreating behind the Isar, behind Munich. And about this, they didn't do. Moreau decided to concentrate at Hohenlinden, an area which he knew very well due to the armistice. And the second armistice was actually signed at the Gaststätte in Hohenlinden itself. And he decided to concentrate there because there are some important crossroads. That was his decision. And he decided to make a stand and not to withdraw. The Austrians, Dave will explain it also, they got the wrong impression. They thought, okay, they're in full retreat. And people always say the Austrians, they are timid and they are not very offensive. But when you read the orders of Johann, then you will see they are really pushing for an all-out offensive. So this is a very deciding event, the battle of Hauen or of Ampfing. But Moreau's army is too dispersed, so he's only able to concentrate out of four corps two, his own and Grenier's. And then back to David.
Yes, as you say, the result of Ampfing was that the Austrians believed that this was the main French army and that it was in full-scale retreat. They expected the French to put up a fight at a place called Haag, also on the main road down towards the southwest, on the 2nd of December. But they got there, found the French had evacuated the place completely, and this convinced them that the chances were the French were only going to put up a stand actually at Munich, and the most they thought they would run into would be a rear guard. And of course, as Hans Karl said, there's some open ground there just to the east of Hohenlinden, kind of between Hohenlinden and the great Haag Forest, which will feature in the battle. And so the orders are there to advance, but in some ways it looks more like an advance to concentrate the various columns in one place. Rather than actual attack on the French. And the problem then becomes that Cholera, who has the central column, is on the main road and he's got the reserve. So you've got a lot of grenadiers and heavy cavalry and heavy artillery moving along that road, whereas really you would expect the other divisions to be out in front in a battle. So it's going to throw them kind of off balance with that as well.
Yeah, they wanted to concentrate at Anting.
Yeah.
which is the headquarter of Model, by the way. Or was the headquarter of Model.
So it really seems that these first days of the campaign were almost confusing for both sides. Maybe not confusing, but they jumped to the wrong conclusions in some cases. I mean, Moreau was surprised by the attack at Ampfing. Then these, not quite suitable approach of the Austrian to Hohenlinden. And I think that leads us to the day of the battle itself. So, in the morning hours, I think they meet the first fighting starts about around Hohenlinden. Maybe David starts first, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, the setup is basically you have Colorat has the reserve, about 20,000 troops, and they're on this main Munich Vienna, a nice well constructed road in decent condition. And to the north of him is La Tour, and to the south is Riesch. And the three of them are supposed to kind of come up in line, but obviously La Tour and Riesch are on side tracks. This is thick, typical Bavarian fir wood forest, and it's about 5 kilometers wide. And so they've got to get through on these bad tracks. And then to the north of these three columns is Kienmayer. He's also got about 16,000 troops. And he was originally the kind of the advance guard for this sweeping advance that they'd originally planned. So he's coming down, intending really to move against the left wing of any French attack. So you've got what you actually have. The first thing that happens really is the Colorats around 7 o'clock, and that they've broken camp at 5, and about 7, his advance guard, again under Lippert, it's just a couple of Grenzer battalions, IR Infantry Regiment 31, which is Benyovsky, is one of the Transylvanian regiments, and 10 squadrons of Hussars engage the 108th Demi Brigade under Marconnet. Just before the forest starts, but Marconnet just kind of made a fighting withdrawal, which again reinforces this idea that the French are just withdrawing. And so Colorat chases him into the forest, but as he's getting in there, he then reinforces the advance guard with a couple of battalions of grenadiers and some Bavarians, and they push the French out the other side. But the problem is, as they emerge, they realize they've got no supporting columns either side. And suddenly there's a load of French troops out on this open open ground, where, of course, they've got the artillery and they've got the cavalry. French cavalry can maneuver, whereas the Austrians are in this column and they're trying to deploy. And so as they emerge, the French launch a counterattack. There was the 11th Chasseurs à Cheval actually launched a series of attacks by each one of their four squadrons on a grenadier battalion as it initially tried to kind of form line, and then when it saw the cavalry tried to form square. And so by the time the fourth squadron had gone in, it was broken up and took the whole thing apart. And so they were having severe difficulties there, and Colorat also lost the battery. And so he realized that there was no point going any further forward because his supporting side columns weren't there. And so he stopped. But Latour and Riesch are both about 3 hours march behind, still trying to struggle along these muddy tracks.
I think before we jump to the French perspective, maybe it's quite a suitable moment to talk about the terrain, actually, because as you said, I actually did my homework and visited the battlefield.
Just a short question.
Yeah, of course.
But Lippert was already there. This I did not find out when he was, because he was the advance guard.
Mm.
And the all armies, you can say what you want, they started very early at about 4 o'clock, 4 to 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
And what we have to consider is it was pitch black. That has no artificial lighting, nothing. And you have to move 10,000 of men. And I think we underestimate always completely how difficult all this is. 4 o'clock in the winter time, pitch black, so they start moving. But I don't know when Leopard was he already at this position at the exit of the Großhager Forest on the day before, or was it just only an advance guard 1 or 2 hours in front of Kolovrat?
It was just in front. The first engagement with Markinay and the 108th is on the east side of the forest. And so okay. The advance guard goes up against the 108th and pushes them back into the forest. And there's kind of a sort of a fighting withdrawal through the forest.
And by the way, the man commanding on the spot was Grouchy.
Yes.
On the French side, the hero of Belle Alliance.
Yes, always good to see these. Of course, Napoleon was always a little bit suspicious of what he called the German marshals, I think. And you got Ney and you got Grouchy.
It's a prominent list of names. But actually, yes, what I wanted to say, I did my homework. And during the winter break, I visited the battlefield. And I think to understand the battle, it's really important to imagine this battlefield. There is this big forest, and in addition, it's very, there are many small hills, you can't see far ahead, so you can imagine these Austrian columns coming out of the wood and engaging these French troops. There weren't much space to form functioning lines, and I think, if I read it right, this was a very, very big difference, especially in addition with this foggy and wintry weather. So I think to understand the battle, that's one really, really important point. So we have these encounters during the beginning of the battle. Hey, Alex, I'm sorry, maybe we'll record this we'll give this another try. Okay, then let's do this again. So we have these first encounters.
We have Kolovrat coming through there, but he suddenly discovers he's on his own, and the French are counterattacking with that advantage of being able to use cavalry, which is the thing the Austrians had always had in their favor in many of the revolutionary battles where they've been successful. But now their cavalry is bottled up and the French cavalry are the ones on the loose.
I just want to go on a bit more on the terrain, because the Großhager Forest space is the key part of the whole battle.
Yep.
And also the decision will be made. Maybe it could have different if Bailly Latour would have acted differently. But the problem is with Kolovrat, his whole column, he has all the baggage wagons with him. So. Mm-hmm. The road is completely blocked with baggage wagons and troops. And I was there on the battlefield as well. I had a complete tour with some locals, and they showed me all these nice places. And Richebonse, and later when we come back, he used the Schweiger Weg, which is now a very nice forest road. But at this time, it was very narrow, and sometimes only one man could march, which runs parallel to the road where Kolovrat is marching to the west. So this was a very, very lucky thing for the French, actually. And I don't know if they did know that. But the big problem, which I see from the Austrians, was, again, you know, they were still thinking they were in pursuit. They had all the baggage wagon with them, and the troops were not well placed. And also, as usual, who is in command? Johann was there as well. Kolovrat was there. Leopard was there. And then, of course, Weyrother. But maybe we come then back later to them. And as you say, Grouchy was in the clearing. When you come out of the forest, there's a clearing. And they formed a sort of a half circle. And they had two small villages, which they defended. But the Austrians, actually, they almost outflanked them on the left. And then almost on the right. I don't know how much you want to go into detail of this battle, but the most important thing is that they couldn't break through, and Grouchy was able to hold the defensive position in front of Hohenlinden.
Okay, so I mean, I don't think we have to go in like on every demi-brigade level, but it's important to get the bigger picture of the battle. So we have this situation that the Austrians come out, are pinned down in the center, and maybe David, tell us what's happening around that. How are the Austrians adjusting?
Yeah, to the north of Colorat is Latour's column, but he's about 3 hours behind. It's snowing or sleet coming. And he's got the problem, an interesting problem that recurs during the Napoleonic Wars. Of course, he can hear firing to the south and the north. To the south is Colorat, and to the north is Kienmayer on this more sweeping move against the French left. He's not quite sure what to do, and he makes this decision to break his two divisions up and support the two side columns to him. And so he's breaking them up into about four or five different groups. And as he reaches the village of Midbach, it sounds like the fighting, as we would expect, is more fierce around Colorat to the south. And so he sends more of his troops down that way. But what he finishes up with, really, is it's about three battalions and some cavalry, about six squadrons, who would do nothing all day. But the rest of them are these small groups, couple of battalions, maybe an artillery battery, that sort of thing, moving fairly randomly through this woodland and bad terrain, trying to assist both Colorat and also the advance of Kienmayer. Now, Kienmayer is coming in from the northeast through Essen and Buch. And in this case, the French know pretty much what to expect. And they're playing into the Austrian plan. It's almost as though they realize that the Austrians think they're pursuing. And so they pull back on the northern end of the French line onto Grenier's main line of defense. And so Kienmayer, again, it's this problem with the terrain. They can't move in big blocks. And so he splits his force into two, partly under Archduke Ferdinand d'Este, who heads directly west to seize Harthofen. And the other part is under General Mayor Prince Karl Schwarzenberg. And he leads the other column in a more southwesterly movement across, again, down one of these really bad tracks to attack the French divisions under Bastoul, who replaced Hardy, who'd been wounded at Ampfing, and Ney around Kronacker. And these are about 1.5 kilometres north of Hohenlinden. And Schwarzenberg actually probably puts up the best performance of the day, and he got his troops organized into two lines, so their attack was effective. But Moreau then commits the reserve cavalry to support a counterattack by Bastoul and Ney. And in the south, Riche is seriously behind. He only got to Albashing at 9:30, so the fighting is already underway, and he's hardly getting into the area. And he's so slow about it that, as Hans Karl will tell us about the French counterattack, things get a little bit interesting. So I'll pass it to Hans Karl for Richepants.
The thing is, Moreau planned that Grenier should be on a defensive position. A lot of people are like a Bonaparte because he cannot stand anybody who's as good as himself. He's then later on is jabbing very badly against Moreau. And they said it was all pure accident that he the battle was won. Okay, luck is always necessary, as we all know. Without luck, no win. But Grenier already should be on a defensive position. This was planned the day before. And we come then back later to response, which I'm able to cover it in great detail in Decon. And originally, Decon, which is a division which belonged to Moreau, should come and reinforce the center. But Decon told Moreau, now he can't do it. So Moreau decided he's going along with response. But Grenier, he should be on the defensive. And they had the strict order to be on the defensive. And Moreau will then decide when they will counterattack. And this is what happened on this part as well. And due to the failure of Bailly-Latour, Ney, which we will come back later again, got a free hand. He was not pinned by Latour. And only by this, along with the defense of Grouchy and then later response Descamps, the decision fell on the battlefield. But Grenier was purely defensive from start one of the
battle. So it seems like in these following hours of the battle, the Austrians almost get a grip of what is happening. They realize they're encountering something bigger, but they don't really have the initiative to act efficiently, as I'm understanding. And so in addition with this, like as we already told, unsoothing battlefield for this offensive, I think they, if I'm right, they playing just in the French cards and don't even commit their whole army to the battle.
Well, they plan to commit. They plan to commit. If it would work, if it would have worked as usual, this was not a bad plan. But then the problem with the Austrians at this time is that, in contrast to the French, they had the commanders of those divisions, like Bailly Latour, that they took the wrong decisions. Whereas the French, they took the right decisions. But so, the plan in itself, if Bailly Latour would have taken directly in the center direction to Hohenlinden, then they would be not able to act freely against Kolovrat. And so it was not a bad plan, but it failed, I think, in my opinion. It was the wrong decisions of of the column leaders, like Bailly Latour or also Kolovrat. He should have realized that something seriously is going on. And but what could he do? He was stuck in the forest. And of course, Riche, he informed him at 7:30 already that he is not in time. He's lagging behind.
And Riche Kolovrat is on the left side of
Riche is the left-hand column. And Kolovrat was informed by Riche that he will be late, but Riche still thought at this time, I'm only in pursuing a retreating enemy. So that played well into the hands of the French.
Okay. Speaking of the French, now we have this situation that this uncoordinated attack in the center is going on. What is the response of the French? How do they develop this battle from this point on?
Well, the idea was that Richepons should do a flanking attack. And this was decided the day before at the evening. So it was no accident, but it could have gone completely wrong, of course. It's always you need two to for a dance, you know. So, but they were lucky on this. And then, of course, Descamps was ordered to follow Richepons because he would not be in time in the French center. So this was luck, I say. Because if he would have made it, then he would have stayed with Grouchy maybe or Dautoul in the center of Hohenlinden. But then he was behind Richepons. And Richepons, he assembled already at 7 o'clock at Schützen. I don't know how much you know about the battlefield. St. Christoph Schützen, that's the, what is it? That's the southern part of the forest. And he was marching on a sort of a parallel road to the Hager Road. The Hager Road was the main road, direction Hohenlinden. And it's still there, the Schweiger Weg, it still exists. It's now a nice forest road where you can drive with your car, and I drove with it. It was easy, but at this time it was a very bad road and bad weather, snowing. People say you had 10 to 15 meters sight vision, otherwise you couldn't see. Then the guide of Richepons, he deserted, so Richepons was stuck. And what a lot of people forget, Kolovrat detached two grenadier battalions to march to Schützen. And when you look at the map, we see there is a crossroad in the Hager Forest. And so these two Austrian battalions, they all of a sudden emerge in the middle of the French column. So there's a bit of panic, of course, of Richepons, because nobody was thinking that there will be under Austrian attack. But then Drouet, another hero of Belle Alliance, Drouet de Alon, maybe people know him better under this name, he's rallying actually this column. And then Richebeau makes the decision to leave Drouet with reinforcements from his original force behind and wait till Decamps comes in case more Austrians are coming up. So they want to be on the defensive if Rich comes up. And Moreau marches with the rest of this unit to direction east, to the exit of Marsmeyer and Meidenbeet. And that was the entrance of the Austrians of Kolovrat when he entered the forest. But he is now only two brigades strong. And already from the brigades, he detached more infantry. So it's only two demi-brigades and I think one cavalry regiment. And it's mainly the brigade Walter and Sahuk. And then he decides to attack the column of Kolovrat from the rear. But surprise, at his right-hand side or eastern side, they are Austrian cavalry, which is Kienmayer. So when we, it's not easy what Richebeau has to do. And I'm actually surprised how they pulled it off. Because on one hand, they have to defend against Kienmayer's cavalry, which attacked again and again. And they have to split again. And only one demi-brigade, three battalions, actually attack against the rear of Kolovrat columns, which is, of course, confusion because they have the wagons, the truss. And then, Dave will know this, Kolovrat sent Bavarian infantry, at least three battalions, to counterattack. But somehow, they couldn't manage to stop Richebeau. And then later, of course, Richebeau was saved by Decamps because when Rich arrived, he was there to block the advance of Rich. So very difficult thing. And I'm surprised, actually, that with such a small amount of units, three battalions, about 2,500 men, Richebeau was able to crush the rear of the mighty column of Kolovrat.
I mean, to get this in relation, Richebeau took, you said, three demi-brigades, like so far off the main body of the French army and took these flanking attack. Would it be fair to say that this risky decision was like the decisive moment of the battle?
Yeah, I think it was. I think the thing was, of course, the French thought they were moving against the Austrian left wing. But that's Rich, and he's so far behind. So Richebeau has come in between Kolovrat and Rich. So there is nothing there to protect Kolovrat at all, except these two grenadier battalions that initially engage and cut Richebeau's column in half. But yes, the Richebeau then uses his initiative and he carries on because he knows the key thing is to get up on to the main road at Meitenbeth. And before very long, Decamps, who's come up from the south, is now reinforcing him. And so Rich can't take much of an effective part in the battle. And so although Richebeau only had a relatively handful of troops, of course, the Austrians aren't expecting anything to come up onto the main road. There's no kind of rear guard on the back of Kolovrat's column. In the end, it's a combination, as Hans Karl was saying, of some Bavarian battalions being sent down, part of them engaged there with Drouet d'Erlon, and then another three went back to the rear of Kolovrat's column. And Liechtenstein's cavalry, which is the reserve cavalry, was also turned round. But you're turning cavalry round on a well-constructed road. It's not the easiest thing to do. And they are having to attack in fairly small forces, which is making it easier for the French to hold them. But the key thing is, of course, they're sat on the rear. And suddenly everybody in Kolovrat's column realizes what's going on.
The decisive thing was that the Austrians or Kolovrat, they realized that something serious is going on in their rear. Because initially they thought it's nothing. It's just whatever, some stragglers or whatsoever, and it wasn't taken seriously. But then it was, and then it was a sort of, I wouldn't say panic, but they tried to get out, but they realized they couldn't because the roads are completely blocked by baggage trains. And the Rish boss had the guts really to press this through. He realized he cut at least part of the line, but he was squeezed in already. You know, on one side was Kolorad, on the other side was Liechtenstein's cavalry. Mm. So and Liechtenstein, he was not he didn't watch. He attacked again and again. And there's another one, Radetzky. He was commander of Albert Kürassiere there, and he took part and he wrote some very strange fairy tale comments about his part in the Battle of Hohenlinden, yes. like where he said he attacked with Weyroder, and Weyroder was the horse was shot under him. But there was already there was no connection between Kolorad and Liechtenstein any longer. This was completely cut. But it's true that Weyroder went back to the rear to get a picture. And he was running into the counter into the attack of the French when they overrun a Bavarian battery, and he was wounded and the shot the horse was killed under him. And it's quite surprising for me that a chief of staff is acting like a unit commander, but he's not alone in this. Other famous generals like Scharnhorst did the same foolish things again and again. So yes, it was one of the decisive things, but another very decisive thing is the inactivity, in my opinion, of La Tour Bayet and detaching all the units. And response is late, but I won't blame him because bad weather conditions, unknown to any territory. When he started, it was pitch black. So how to move these 10,000 men under unknown terrain, roads? Some people say he got lost. But when he arrived, it was too late.
I mean, what my question is, you told us about Weyroder, who is, of course, the chief of staff, but where is Archduke John? And what is he doing in this moment? I mean, he has to realize that one of his columns is completely cut off. What is the Austrian response from this point on?
It isn't a great deal. Archduke John basically just did a runner on a fast horse. he just got out of it. And so
can you blame him?
Well, no, I don't blame him at all, but it's perhaps not a great example of leadership when things are, this is as things are falling apart, and Richepons has managed to secure his position. And he's even looking the other way, back towards Haag, to see what's going on around there. But the problem with Riche, it's the same as Latour. He broke his force up into about five groups. And, of course, facing a unified French force, Drouet, that's half of Richepons, and plus Descamps, it's all together. He's outnumbered anyway. And these small units are now being swept up one at a time as the French advance forward.
Yeah, it's a typical Austrian recipe for disaster, which we will encounter again at 1805 at Ulm. You know, the Archduke, he's nominally commander, but then he's told, oh, you have the grey eminences in the back. You must listen to them. You have no decision to make. So I mean, all his self-confidence is taken away. He has to obey Lauer, and he has to obey to Weyrauder's advance. So what can he do? Nothing. I mean, he's just a symbol, a figurehead.
Oh,
and
yes.
He signs maybe the orders. That's all he do. So he's busy with Kolovrat, as you say. And he is, of course, fleeing. And he got out, luckily. But he was in danger to get prison as well. By the way, the French... I think it was the Ney. He's then also attacking. We don't have to forget that only Richepons is attacking, but also then Grouchy and Ney, they keep the initiative. And then also the other troops of Grenier, they go on the initiative again, and they counterattack. And the Austrians, they already realize something is going wrong, and they slowly withdraw. And then the French, they capture Deroy. Bavarian general was killed later in 1812 campaign, and also Spannocci. And the interesting thing is Spannocci. He was the tutor of Archduke Charles, of Karl.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And when Karl realized that Spannocci was taken prisoner, he asked Moreau to release him. And what did Moreau? He released him.
Quite a character. Okay. This is
what's happening now as Moreau can see the sort of smoke rising on the other side of the forest. He realizes the response has broken through. And as Hans Karl said, he's ordered a general advance along the whole line. And Latour, as Hans Karl said, he's got nothing left. He can't prevent Ney joining in with Grouchy against Collarat's column. And then up in the north, Kienmaier realizes that there's no point in him going any further. And he's just ordered his divisional commanders, that's Archduke Ferdinand d'Este and Schwarzenberg, to pull back. And they got out reasonably successfully. The main losses are in Collarat's column, which lost about 60 cannon, but there weren't too many losses for Kienmaier. He's about 500 prisoners or so, nothing too serious. And Schwarzenberg, as I said, is the only one that really comes out of this with any credit. And at one point he was pretty much surrounded and was invited to surrender, but he cut his way out. And then he
maybe Ney took notice for later.
Maybe. And Schwarzenberg then was able to get round, and he kind of formed the rear guard against the French on the main road as they fell back, and got what was left of the reserve artillery back to the inn. So he was the only one that came out of it. The Bavarian casualties are quite small, which suggests they may not have been too enthusiastic. Although, to be fair, having half of them having been sent down towards Riesch there around Schutzen, they probably didn't get engaged at all.
Good point, actually. I mean, what is striking to me is we always talk in this big picture of the generals and even the like panic fleeing of Archduke John, but it really must have been horrific to be a common soldier in Collarat's column, or even in the other attack columns, being surrounded and marching in with the picture of just following a fleeing French army, and then coming out of this forest. And I mean, the next, what will it be, 3 to 4 hours, it must have been horrific to don't see anything, see these blocked roads, hear the news of French being in the rear. You can only imagine these chaotic circumstances on the battlefield.
That's always the problem, is you don't know where the French are going to appear from next. They've got Grouchy and Ney coming in there from the west, and they know the French are out to the east, but of course there's nothing there to the south. They could be coming up from there as well. So it's like a net, almost like a net sort of forming around them. And so the whole army's broken up.
Maybe to jump to the French again for a second. They have the Austrians on the run. Maybe Hans Karl, you can tell us what are their next steps? What are the results for them of the battle? We already heard about the Bavarian casualties and what the Austrians lost.
Not a lot, actually, because it was very hard fighting for them as well. And as you say, we underestimate the exhaustion, bad weather conditions. Interesting is that at the end of the battle, the son of Hohenlinden comes out. And that's also when Moreau has a better look. They pursue to a certain extent, but then they had to stop, because usually they all engaged. Their all divisions were engaged. And you will see later in the campaign, then Le Corps Corps, who did not take part, he plays a very prominent part in the attack on Salzburg. When they advance farther, then Moreau is using very intelligently the corps of Le Corps and other corps, other divisions, which were not fully engaged. But also the French were exhausted, and like they have about 10,000 prisoners at hand. They have somehow to get to organize the amount of prisoners, what to do with them, how to guard them. And then they captured about 70 to 80 cannons and over 100 ammunition wagons. So I think also the French, especially Richebourg, Decaux, and also very likely Moreau, realized that it was not so easy as it looked, or even as it is represented now, because it could have gone wrong on some points still. And it was a hard-fought victory, which, in my opinion, is due to the better interaction of the French divisional commanders, in contrast to the Austrians, where the columns had so sort of everybody fought for himself, and not in a bigger picture as the French divisions did.
Yeah, this is always the thing about momentum, is once you get that, I mean, the actual dead and wounded, I think, were about 4,500. But it's the captured. They lost nearly 9,000 plus all this artillery. And so they effectively ceased to be an effective fighting force.
Yeah, it must have been devastating. I mean, maybe we can go quick through the, I'd say, road to Vienna from then. You already talked about the pursuit a bit and the engagement at Salzburg. But what is happening after the battle, leading up to, of course, the Peace of Luneville? What were the stations there? I mean, we don't have to get in too big of a detail, but maybe a quick run through.
Yes, Archduke Charles finally decided to take command on the 17th of December, a couple of weeks later. He assembled what forces they could get, but I mean, the militias and the insurrection were refusing to assemble anyway. But Charles famously went out and dismissed five of the generals on the parade by breaking their swords. But he marched out towards Steyr, which is it's just south of Linz. It's about 80 kilometers from Vienna. But he realized there was no point going on. And he requested an armistice, which Moreau granted on the 25th of December. And then the Treaty of Luneville would be the beginning of February 1801.
Okay. Maybe we got some glimpses into that already, but maybe now would be a good point to talk about the legacy of the battle. Hans Karl said in some cases it gets described at this like climax of the War of the Second Coalition, and after that it was pretty much gone. But on the other hand, of course, in the podcast Marengo was already talked about deeply. And the thing is, it's when I was first starting researching for this episode, I was looking for books about Hohenlinden, and it was incredibly tough to find any. And everything that I found were books about Marengo. And even the book I got about Marengo and Hohenlinden, I think it was 430 pages, and like 30 pages from that were about the actual Battle of Hohenlinden. So it always gets a bit swept under the rug. And I mean, I promised we will talk about a bit about Napoleon. I think it has to do with this role, so maybe we start with his reaction to the battle. What was he saying when he found out about Moreau's victory, and what was his maybe handling with the Army of the Rhine?
Yeah, so Bonaparte, of course, officially he praised Moreau, but unofficially he realized that this is a very potential rival for him, because he fought one of the best campaigns similar to the Italian campaign of Bonaparte, or similar to Archduke Charles' campaign in Germany in 1796, which was as good or as important as the one of Bonaparte. And already there, sort of, animosity is coming up between Moreau and Bonaparte. It was also in the preparation to the campaign, and also during the campaign itself. And you have to think, you know, a man with such an overblown ego as Bonaparte, when Moreau tells him, look, you know, the best general and the best army must fight in Germany, because there the decision will happen. This is says before the campaign starts. This is says into the face of Napoleon. And I think this is the beginning of the end of the friendship or cooperation between Moreau and Bonaparte. And also the Armée de Reims was very Republican. It maybe was the last revolutionary army based on virtue. And of course, this could not go on in a system with Bonaparte. So on one hand, I understand Bonaparte that he has to say, okay, I cannot go on with these. I have to get rid of them somehow, which he did. But in the end, a lot of very able, talented French generals were not used in the Napoleonic Wars or only at the end of the Napoleonic Wars. And like, for example, Grenier, he fought then during the whole Napoleonic Wars, but then in Italy and on sideshows. Moreau, of course, he had to go to exile because he was accused to take part in as a conspirator against Napoleon. Le Corp, one of the best corps commanders the French army had at all, he only fought then for France again in 1815. And then he proved how good he was, because with this tiny force, he kept his defensive intact. This was a big tragedy in the end for the whole French, let's say, republic or consulate. But then the corruption of Napoleon crept in, and that was the end of the Armée de Reims. And of course, then it had to be downplayed. And our problem is we still judge all these things by the eyes of Napoleon. We read how did he comment about this, and this we take on. Instead of saying, okay, we form our own opinion, and everybody who studies the campaign will say this was a superb campaign of Moreau and his army. And of course, Hohenlinden brought the decision it was a major decision of the 1800 campaign. But Dave will then later, I think you will touch Pozzolo, which is also a very important battle and also completely forgotten again, because again, Bonaparte did not take part, but it was of equal importance, I have to say, then Marengo. And that's a big tragedy, like, as you say, you know, you find knowledge about the Battle of Marengo, the dirt under the fingernails of every general, but about Hohenlinden, nobody knows anything. And then it's a lucky victory of Moreau and against a bad Austrian army. And that's, at least for me, it's not the case. It was one of the best armies. And it was one of the best commanders who, by the way, was vindicated later when the French got their humiliation at the 1870-71 campaign, which they fought on Napoleon's kind of strategic operational art of war. And of course, they lost very badly. And then they say Moreau was a much better general to train and to command units and bring up better generals than Bonaparte did. Because where Bonaparte was absent, the army failed. But Moreau, he could be absent, and like Le Corp, he could pursue up to Salzburg and more on his own. So he had very good unit leaders, and he was also, in my opinion, a team player. And it's a pity for me. But there are very good books available. Of course, not in English. Best thing is to discard them altogether. But there is like Picard. He wrote a very good book about the 1800 campaign in French and about the battle. And he also wrote a very good book about the rift between Bonaparte and Moreau. It's a book only about the relationships between Moreau and Bonaparte. And of course, then the Austrian sources. And then the recent source of Günter Schneider in German, which is a nice book. And then there's some good, like this one, I don't think a lot of people know this. This I bought at the museum in Hohenlinden. And so you can make your own mind, and you're not predisposed to propaganda stories. That's the good thing. If you do your own research, which is not paved by the usual propaganda spread out by Napoleon.
Yes, I think his propaganda was very successful. Yeah. Desailles was buried up on the Grand St. Bernard Pass, having taken no part in the famous crossing. And Kléber, as I discovered from listening to the podcast, was put on the Chateau d'If off Marseille for 18 years. So nobody was, and there was no parade for the Army of the Rhine, unlike for the Army of Italy, just after its campaign. So he's certainly thinking in terms of propaganda.
Well, as you say, Moreau gets even more victimized because he had to go into exile. And then in 1813, he comes back. And the Russian emperor, he took him into his suite. And then, of course, you see Moreau in Russian generals or field marshals uniform. But he never wore it. He never wore it. He had civilian clothes. And then he gets, of course, killed at the Battle of Dresden, or mortally wounded, and he dies later.
I think we have to be careful not if that Alex gets angry of us if we talk too far about in the future. We can't forget it's a chronological podcast. Yeah, but I think it's after talking for a bit, about an hour now, I mean, it's fair to say that Hohenlinden was a much more, I'd say, safe win than Marengo. It seems like the French were never in a situation where the battle was so close to being lost, but a well-executed plan from start to finish.
Yeah, so in Marengo, the Austrian army was up for a fight the next day. Hohenlinden, it's just disintegrated.
Yeah. So, yeah, maybe it deserves a more prominent spot in the conversation about the year 1800. I think that's all of the questions for me right now. I'd say again, thank you so much for being part of this. I had a lovely time, my first podcast experience ever. So I hope I managed the hosting part quite well. I think we'll have to see what Alex has to say about it. He told me to remind the listeners about the email address. It was thenapoleonicquarterly@gmail.com. So if anyone has a question, just send your message to Alex. Maybe he will reach it out to us. And yeah, thank you so much for listening. In the future, I never did this outro thing before, as you know. And yeah, goodbye.